The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're starting today with Lifestyle. This article is entitled, Oprah Responds to the Devastation in Maui. Hey everybody, you know what this week has taught me? Is that when you don't know what to do, you do whatever you can. I have family members who were staying here with me here in Maui. At first we thought, at beginning of the week, that we were going to have to evacuate. Then the winds changed. Then on Tuesday evening I was coming back from a hike and saw this wall of black smoke on the west side of Maui. That's behind me over there. The smoke was so thick it was covering the sun. I didn't know at that moment that it was the town of Lahaina being incinerated. Since then, I've really not known what to do. I went to visit one of the big shelters here at the War Memorial and asked people what they needed, then went shopping for basic items like towels and sheets, shampoo and other necessities. I will make a major donation after all of the smoke and ashes have settled, and we figure out what the rebuilding is going to look like. This is going to be a long and difficult process. Spending time at the shelters, I've met so many incredible people. To one guy, Julius, I said, "Julius, tell me what you need." Because his legs were covered in bandages where he had to run to escape the fire, he said that he could feel his skin popping as he was running. He got out of his car because the tires were melting and he couldn't move forward, and he just started to run. When I said, "Tell me what you need," he said, "Ma'am, I need nothing. My life is now my greatest gift. I have my life." I've seen so many families who are sharing a cot, an air mattress, and have nothing else left to their names, but they are so grateful just to have each other. And there is such an incredible spirit in this entire community, with people helping each other, with people helping other people. I know that long after all the camera crews are gone and the rest of the world has moved on, the rebuilding will just begin. And Hawaiians are a strong cultural people and a family-loving people. And with help and support, you're going to see a lot of Phoenix rising from the ashes stories, because the aloha spirit is real, y'all, and it has been tested this week to the ultimate max. I thank you for all of your prayers and your sentiments, and everybody in this community thanks you for anything you can offer or give at this time. We at Oprah Daily have vetted the charities that you'll see below if you wish to donate to. I don't have an intention this week, only to just do whatever I can, and I hope the same for all of you. Do what you can. Organizations helping the residents of Maui. Hawaii Red Cross. The Hawaii Red Cross has shelters set up across Maui and Hawaii's islands for evacuees displaced by the fires. You can donate to support these shelters through its website or text the word Red Cross, REDCROSS, to TO90999 to make a $10 donation. Maui Humane Society. The Maui Humane Society is seeking emergency foster families to help house pets who have been lost, burned, or affected by the smoke. You can donate funds through its site, but it also has an Amazon wish list of supplies that will help those taking in the animals. To learn more about its SOS fostering program, you can click here. In books, we have five books we'd put in Barbie's Dreamhouse Library. The doll's head may be hollow, but we know she's got brains. We've long suspected that Barbie is a secret bookworm. How else is she supposed to pass those long, dreary hours between playtimes? But Barbie's Dreamhouse set finally gave us the proof we needed. A copy of a book titled Moby Barbie, complete with a bubblegum pink whale tail illustration resting casually on the doll's nightstand. Well, many viewers went wild trying to imagine how themes from Melville's masterpiece might emerge in Greta Gerwig's fantastically plastic universe. We had a different question. What else is Barbie reading? Read on for our best guesses for the books that might fill her dream house shelves. Number 1, In the Dream House by Carmen Maria Machado. In our pretend world, Barbie picks up Machado's experimental memoir because she finds the title deeply relatable. Sadly, she discovers that this Folio Prize-winning book is not a tale about the woes of cooking in a kitchen where all your appliances are stickers. Instead, a few chapters in, she realizes that this is a moving account of Machado's early relationship with an emotionally abusive woman told, again and again, through different literary tropes, as a choose-your-own-adventure story, as a lesbian cult classic, as a stoner comedy, and more. Like the abuse itself, the repeated story is simultaneously soliloquial and constantly surprising, pushing all readers, queer and straight, plastic and human, to question the limits of narrative and the power of self-determination. Not what Barbie was expecting, but we like to think she'd give it 5 stars. Number 2, Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg. Barbie is proof that a woman really can have it all. The beautiful house, the handsome man, the bustling social life, and the career. Actually, in Barbie's case, over 200 of them. How does Barbie manage to balance her professional responsibilities as an astrophysicist, a professional skateboarder, a dentist, and a Pizza Hut cashier, while still making time to beekeep, surf, and host seemingly constant, elaborately themed parties? Simple. She asserts herself. As Sheryl Sandberg, the former chief operating officer of Meta Platforms, argues in this 2013 manifesto on female professional achievement, men still run the world in part because women hold ourselves back in ways both big and small, by lacking self-confidence, by not raising our hands, by pulling back when we should be leaning in. While some have criticized Sandberg for underemphasizing the external, systemic barriers to women's professional empowerment, Barbie's world is only as big as her box and your imagination. For her, attitude is everything. Maybe that's how Barbie has managed to make it to so many places where no actual woman has yet gone. The Oval Office, the moon. Number 3. Confessions of a Shopaholic by Sophie Kinsella. Shopping is actually very similar to farming a field, reflects Becky Bloomwood, the stylish protagonist of Kinsella's 2000 hit novel. You can't keep buying the same thing. You have to have a bit of variety. Otherwise, you get bored and stop enjoying yourself. Barbie, who by some estimates has a total of 1 billion outfits, including a farmer getup, knows of what Becky speaks. While there are some crucial differences between the two, for example, Becky is a British human with some serious credit card debt, and Barbie is a plastic American with beachfront property in Malibu, the two are united by their passion for fashion and by how far they are willing to go for a perfect stiletto. Number 4. The Pink Book by Kay Blegvad, and that's spelled B-L-E-G-V-A-D. Pretty self-explanatory. The book is about the color pink. Pink is Barbie's favorite color. Kay Blegvad provides adorable illustrations alongside some fascinating facts, short essays, and fast-paced interviews about the most iconic color. Naturally, Barbie would have to dig it. Number 5. American Plastic by Jeffrey L. Michael. And Michael is spelled M-E-I-K-L-E. Most of us flesh and blood readers would understand this book as a well-researched academic text outlining the history and technology of plastic products in the United States. Barbie, on the other hand, would likely read this as her own personal Our Bodies, Ourselves. Life in plastic is fantastic, but it's also confusing. What exactly is Barbie made of? Where did she come from? How is she connected to the world around her? Where will she one day end up? These are questions we all must ask. But in Barbie's case, they have refreshingly literal answers, all contained in this comprehensive scholarly account. Thanks, Dr. Michael. We're now looking in the relationship section, and this one is entitled, Why Introverts Are More Effective Leaders. People who don't crave the spotlight are driven by integrity, not ego. Meek is not the first word anyone would use to describe me, and yet I identify as an introvert. Famous introvert Glennon Doyle once crawled inside of my brain and wrote, I am a sensitive, introverted woman, which means that I love humanity, but actual human beings are tricky for me. I love people, but not in person. For example, I would die for you, but not, like, meet you for coffee. She is me. What are we to do, then, when we figure out who we are and that person isn't the type who likes to put themselves out there? What if playing bigger and making our own luck just isn't our natural state? If you are an avowed introvert or you just feel shy about putting yourself out there in some new way, you're not alone. 1/3 to 1/2 of us are introverts, according to Susan Cain, the author of Quiet. But when it comes to our professional lives, somehow we all get the message that we're supposed to be outgoing and uninhibited. Introverts are routinely passed over for leadership positions, Cain says in her TED Talk. Even though introverts tend to be very careful, much less likely to take outside risks, which is something we might all favor nowadays. Whereas extroverts more often put their own stamp on things, introverts can deliver superior outcomes because they are far more likely to give employees the freedom to run with fresh, diverse ideas. Introverts and extroverts need each other. What's more, the world needs us both. And we don't have to be just one or the other. Being introspective or wary at times is just as natural as being a live wire. But if you're hesitant to step out of the shadows and show your truest self, remember that your inclination toward introversion often means you listen more and see more. You're probably more patient than other people, and you typically lead not out of ego, but out of the desire to build a better future. Some of the most admired leaders through history, from Abraham Lincoln and Eleanor Roosevelt to Mahatma Gandhi and Rosa Parks, were introverts whose behavior did not conform to expectations. But being an introvert has a special power and worth of its own, Cain points out. These leaders were at the helm not because they enjoyed directing others and not out of the pleasure of being looked at, she continues. They were there because they had no choice, because they were driven to do what they thought was right. This drive to do the right thing sometimes compels introverts to act like situational extroverts, playing the part of a showboat and reaping all the benefits that this outward-facing personality brings. As someone who makes my living on the stage and in front of the camera, and who has learned to be unapologetic about who I am under that spotlight, I have a weird confession to make. I still hate center stage. In fact, there is nowhere I'd rather be than stage left. I spent the earliest part of my career working as a campaign staffer, helping get Bill Clinton elected President of the United States. I spent the next part of my career in the White House, building AmeriCorps, which would enable more than 1 million young people to earn stipends for their college education while making their community a better place. Then I went into mission-driven executive search, where my job was to find incredible people and put them in positions where they could help make the world a better place. Every one of those was a stage-left job, even the last one, where for 15 years I was the founder and CEO of a global executive search firm. Although I was often in the spotlight, it was my job to identify and amplify others, whether by recruiting incredible talent or as chief champion of my employees. Even in moments when I was forced to take center stage as CEO, I always redirected the spotlight to others where it more aptly belonged. I liked it there at stage left. It felt like home. Not only had I studied, recruited, stewarded, and coached leaders for the previous 20 years, but my first boss and mentor in the White House was Eli Segal, a man who never saw his name in the headlines, yet shaped history from the sidelines. Eli was a consummate stage-left leader, mild-mannered, not splashy, the sort who would be easy to underestimate. But he had a vision of the way the world should be, and he worked tirelessly behind the scenes to make it so. From a young idealist on Eugene McCarthy's failed 1968 bid for president to chief of staff on Bill Clinton's winning 1992 campaign, Eli was always making deals, connecting people, but never seeking the limelight. After Eli's death, the New York Times dedicated a full page to his obituary. Memorials took place in Boston and Washington, D.C. Senator Ted Kennedy gave the eulogy, saying, "There are over 1,000 of you here today. Every one of you thinks that you were either Eli's best friend or Eli's very good friend. And every one of you is right. Eli wasn't the out-front leader, but people followed him everywhere." Our conventional idea of leadership demands that the more we succeed, the more we get pushed to center stage, even if we don't like it there. We are thrust to the head of the table, when really the relationships and networking happen elsewhere. We are asked to speak more, so we end up listening less. This idealized one-size-fits-all construct actually constructs worst enemies. It is exhausting to be someone else. It's untenable, and it's never going to get you to the person you're meant to be. Your leadership should look like you, a combination of your skills, interests, and energy, not to mention your quirks, moxie, and special brand of awkward. This might mean you occupy center stage sometimes, either literally or just metaphorically, but find a way to thrive there on your own terms, rejoicing in that moment as a lever to accomplish something even bigger. The spotlight may be on you, but the people you love, the cause you serve, and the business you build are the true stars of the show. Still in relationships, this next article is saying goodbye to my bonus mom. How do you eulogize a woman who helped raise an entire town? My two best friends are sisters, a rarity. Even rarer, our fathers were best friends, and our mothers too. It's like when identical twins marry identical twins and have children who are genetically siblings, except we are emotionally siblings, emotionally sisters. Their parents were my emotional parents, and I've called them Little Mama and Big Daddy all my life. When Little Mama died last November, I got the call while sitting in my car in a parking garage. I was hundreds of miles away, surrounded by gray asphalt and reinforced concrete, but I thought I heard the whoosh of Little Mama's soul departing. "Fly fast and high, Little Mama," I thought. "We'll catch up." Her death was not a surprise. Little Mama was 84 and suffered from progressive supranuclear palsy, a Parkinson's-like neurodegenerative disease. The once vibrant, spirited woman I had known had become nearly bedridden, and her quality of life had shrunk down to a pinpoint. In the days following her death, I felt her loss keenly over and over. I would never show her photos of my children again. She would never make Buckeye candies again. And other people's Buckeyes are all inferior. Unbelievable. Unbelievably, Christmas would happen without her. It was like running my hand along a previously smooth shelf and getting a painful splinter a dozen times a day. My best friends asked me if I would write and deliver the eulogy at Little Mama's memorial, and I agreed. I sat at my desk, and the sharp corners of my grief softened a little. A professional writer's uniform is invisible, but it's real, and like all uniforms, it signals to the wearer that work has begun. When I sit at my desk, it's as though a mantle rests on my shoulders, and for as long as I wear that cloak, nothing can intrude. No workaday problems, no sorrowful thoughts, no longing for loved ones. I had written about Little Mama often in my fiction. She was the character who tucked a paper cup of ice in her purse to throw away later, and then when someone asked her for an aspirin, was able to supply two and a cup of water. She was the character who keeps a bottle of Bailey's Irish Cream and some pretty liquor glasses out during December, and has a drink whenever she passes by. Whenever you pass by, one of my best friends said, aren't you drunk by noon? That's in the story, too. She was the extroverted character who has a long talk in the ER with a man who turned out to have had a stroke and could only communicate by blinking. Little Mama didn't actually do that, but she was definitely capable of it. But when you create a character, you build outward from a glimmer of insight. When you write a eulogy, you have to somehow distill a real and complex person down to their essence. How to describe the real person? Well, to start with, she was born and raised in South Carolina, and she retained a gentle drawl all her life. She was all the things Southern people are famous for: gracious and welcoming, kind, charitable. She was truly endlessly interested in everyone. She was always fully present, fully mindful, before mindfulness was even a thing. And she exuded a kind of magic that was way beyond ordinary charm, Southern or otherwise. She never hurried a conversation or rushed a cup of coffee or ignored a visitor. I had never once seen her nervous or flustered about cooking or entertaining, and I had eaten countless delicious meals at her house. When little Mama went into labor with their first child, she didn't go to the hospital until she had baked brownies for Big Daddy to eat later. Big Daddy was golfing and met little Mama at the hospital, where he held her hand and broke down his golf game for her swing by swing to distract her from the pain. The most amazing part of that story to me is that little Mama said she found it pleasantly diverting. I sent an email to little Mama's family and friends, asking them to share their memories with me. People wrote back, raving about how delicious little Mama's scrambled eggs were, and even more important, how she would stay up late or get up early to fix them for late-night arrivals or early morning departures. Her niece remembered how little Mama and Big Daddy drove hours on multiple occasions to watch her high school and college basketball games, and said she always seemed to play better when little Mama was there. Her son-in-law remembered that once on a road trip she sang all the words to the G. Giles, that's G-E-I-L-S, band's centerfold. I realized that whether it was a basketball game or early morning scrambled eggs or a road trip, many people had spent some of the happiest moments of their lives in little Mama's presence. But the thing most people seem to remember most about little Mama was her willingness to spend time with them. One after another, family members wrote to me. She stayed out late to ride the waves with me after everyone else had gone into supper. She arranged an impromptu summer camp at her house. She went down the slide with me when I was too scared. She helped me build sandcastles. She and I rolled down the hill behind our house. She helped me pack for college. She played golf at sunset with me. She showed me how to burp a baby. She taught me how to talk to toddlers. Most people know how to make other people happy. They just don't always do it. For instance, I know it would make my sons happy if I played Assassin's Creed on the PS5 with them, but I'd rather spend my free time watching TikTok recipes of food I will never, ever cook. It would make my husband happy if I stopped asking him to do impersonations all the time, but I don't because my husband is very funny. It would probably make a woman I went to high school with happy if I liked a single one of her Facebook posts, but I don't, because she may not be able to hold a grudge for 30 years, but I certainly can. Little Mama was different. Little Mama knew how to make people happy, and she did it, time and time again. And I realized, surely, that's the definition of an extraordinary life. At the memorial, I sat in the front row. When it was time for me to deliver the eulogy, the pastor introduced me to the congregation as a friend of the family. One of my best friends leaned over and whispered in my ear, "Family, not friend of." I squeezed her hand and stood up. I'm not a good public speaker, especially for someone required to do quite a bit of it. I forget to look up, and I have a bad habit of editing my speech as I go along, of dropping words here and there in order to be done sooner. I get nervous sometimes, and my voice has a tendency to rise and waver. Imagine Minnie Mouse with stage fright. But that day my voice was low and clear, and my gaze remained on the audience instead of my notes. I could tell that they were listening to me and responding. Some people were even nodding their heads in agreement, and everyone in the first few rows was crying. My words had achieved the most basic goal of all writing, engagement. Truly, it was like nothing before. I finished and took my seat again, pleased but a little puzzled. Why couldn't I always be like that? Why had today been so different? And then I realized it was because of Little Mama. Little Mama was never nervous. She spoke slowly and clearly. She charmed people by the churchful. I had been wrong that day in the parking garage when I thought I heard her soul departing. Little Mama was right here, right now. And I had channeled her, and together we had spoken. Afterward, everyone gathered in the vestibule, and we made plans to meet for lunch. I had accidentally left my coat in the seldom-used cloakroom, so I left the church by a different door than the others, unexpectedly finding myself alone. I stood on the steps outside, and the bitter January wind chilled my face and raked cold fingers through my hair. I thought Little Mama's presence would fly off with the wind, that she would soar out over the churchyard, up above the snow-covered town and woods, racing towards the glowing line where the pale blue sky met the frozen land and beyond. But I was wrong again. She stayed with me. She stayed with me all that day and the days that followed. She's with me now. Parts of this article were edited due to time. Okay, we're now in culture and news. This article is Megan Thee Stallion shares emotional message as Tory Lanez receives a 10-year sentence. I'm healing, but I'll never be the same. His crime warrants the full weight of the law, she wrote. 3 years after he shot Megan Thee Stallion in the foot, rapper Tory Lanez has been sentenced to 10 years in prison. Ahead of the sentencing on August 8th, Rolling Stone reported that prosecutors read aloud a statement prepared by Megan, who was not present in court. Her emotional message described the trauma she endured after being shot by Lanez, who was found guilty last December. I struggle with being present. After everything that occurred, I cannot bring myself back to being in the same room with Tory, Megan wrote in her statement, which was read by Los Angeles County Deputy District Attorney Kathy Ta. I've been tormented and terrorized. He paid bloggers to disseminate false information. He treated my trauma like a joke when I could have been dead, she continued. He blamed the system, he blamed the press, and as of late, he is using his childhood trauma to justify his actions. Megan concluded the statement, slowly but surely I'm healing, but I'll never be the same. His crime warrants the full weight of the law. Since his conviction, Lanez has been serving time in jail. He faced up to 22 years in prison. The Body rapper talked about getting through the highly publicized attack in Elle's May 2023 cover story. I don't want to call myself a victim. As I reflect on the past 3 years, I view myself as a survivor because I have truly survived the unimaginable, she said at the time. Not only did I survive being shot by someone I trusted and considered a close friend, but I overcame the public humiliation of having my name and reputation dragged through the mud by that individual for the entire world to see. Of Lanez's conviction, Megan said, when the guilty verdict came on December 23, 2022, it was more than just vindication for me. It was a victory for every woman who has ever been shamed, dismissed, and blamed for a violent crime committed against them. Moving on to another article in culture and news, Sandra Bullock's long-term partner Brian Randall has died, aged 57. His family have released a statement detailing the impossibility of saying goodbye to Brian. Sandra Bullock's long-term partner Brian Randall tragically died over the weekend following a 3-year-long battle with a neurological disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, otherwise known as ALS. Randall's family announced his passing in a statement to People on Monday, 7th August. It read, "It is with great sadness that we share that on August 5th, Brian Randall passed away peacefully after a 3-year battle with ALS. Brian chose early to keep his journey with ALS private and those of us who cared for him did our best to honor his request. We are immensely grateful to the tireless doctors who navigated the landscape of this illness with us, and to the astounding nurses who became our roommates, often sacrificing their own families to be with ours. At this time, we ask for privacy to grieve and to come to terms with the impossibility of saying goodbye to Brian, the statement concluded, which was signed off from his loving family. The Miss Congeniality star reportedly first met Randall in January 2015 when she hired him to take pictures at her son Louis's 5th birthday party. The following year, the model-turned-photographer had officially moved in, with the pair having already made their romance public, which included an appearance at Jennifer Aniston and Justin Theroux's wedding. While speaking on Red Table Talk in December 2021, the actor also detailed how Randall was the love of her life. "We share two beautiful children, 3 children," she said, referring to her 2 kids, Louis, who is now 13, and Lila, 10, plus Randall's older daughter, Skylar, 29. "It's the best thing ever," she added. Randall's family have requested, instead of flowers, donations to be sent to the ALS Association and Massachusetts General Hospital. Our thoughts are with Brian Randall's family and friends at this time. More in culture and news. Simone Biles wins the U.S. Classic upon her gymnastics return. "Tears of joy as I make this comeback," she wrote in an emotional Instagram post. Simone Biles is back on top. The 4-time Olympic gold medalist made a triumphant return to gymnastics over the weekend and came out the all-around winner at the Core Hydration Classic with a score of 59.1000. "Tears of joy as I make this comeback, surrounded by the love you've shown. Thank you for being in me," Biles wrote in an Instagram post Sunday, next to a photo of herself punching the air in celebration. On Twitter, the gymnast added, "Happy to be back out on the floor. This journey has been a roller coaster of emotions. Thank you for believing in me." "So proud of you, baby," Biles' husband, NFL star Jonathan Owens, wrote in the comments section. "Makes my day seeing you so happy and doing what you so happy back and doing what you love and having fun. I love you so much." The classic took place at the Hoffman Estates in Illinois and marked Biles' first competitive event since 2021. She finished in first place in the all-around vault, floor routine, and balance team. She placed 3rd on the uneven bars. Biles famously pulled out of several events at the Tokyo Olympics back in 2021. She said at the time that her mind and body were simply not in sync and that she needed to work on her well-being and mental health. A year later, at the 43rd annual Simmons Leadership Conference, she said that walking away from the Olympic Games to focus on herself had been her biggest win. Still, she told CNN this weekend that she had always planned to return. "I also kind of knew as soon as everything that happened in Tokyo," she said. "So this time I'm doing it for me. I worked a lot on myself and I believe in myself a little bit more, just coming back out here and starting the first steps again." Parts of this article were edited due to time. Yeah, this article is in culture and news, but also books. Read a sneak peek of Kerry Washington's new memoir. The actress and author of the new memoir, Thicker Than Water, reveals the skills she developed that helped her become a performer at home and on screen. "From what I remember, most of my parents' fights were about money and about the fact that neither of them felt like they were in the marriage they wanted to be in, or more precisely, that they were married to the person they wanted to be married to. They argued about my dad's spending versus my mother's thriftiness, my dad's failures to earn versus my mother's failure of ambition, my dad's regular absences versus my mother's obsession with me. They both harbored deep disappointment over what their lives had become. My mother was disappointed in my dad, and my dad was disappointed in the marriage. I had the sense that I was the only thing keeping them together, or that I had to try to be. I was supposed to deliver them to happiness, to avoid triggering in them any emotion, even close to disappointment. So when they fought, I took it as my failure and felt like it was my job to fix it. Like a lot of families, the magic trick was in the pretending. We pretended to ourselves, to each other, and to the outside world that our family was not suffering the pain of life's disappointments. We were fine. But I learned a long time ago that FINE can be an acronym for messed up, insecure, neurotic, and emotional. As a young child, I would lie in bed and listen for signs of how serious each battle was and when it might come to an end. Sometimes the entire fight would consist of my mother slamming a door to signal that she was done. But sometimes the yelling carried on. I developed panic attacks at night. They manifested first as a rhythm of anxiety that encircled my brain, that evolved into a rapid pulsing, a whirling frenzy of metallic thumps, like those nauseating old spinning rides at a country fair. This was not just a feeling. It was a sound, an internal beat or series of beats, though they didn't equate to music. It was the sound of terror, wholly unnatural and unconnected to the rhythm of my heart. I was dizzied with terror. No ground beneath me. It was crazy-making, endless, and sad. There was something so sad about the rhythm, and I couldn't make it stop. I couldn't sleep. It was as though the alarms within me had been triggered, and there was no turning them off. I was 7 years old. It wasn't every single night, but even on peaceful nights, I trembled at the possibility of it. Lying in bed, I would race to fall asleep before the sounds would leak from my bones. I would force myself to try to have a good thoughts. I hated that the rhythm came from within me. I hated that my own brain was not to be trusted. If I lost the race to sleep and got caught by the rhythm, I had no tools to escape it, no way of controlling my own brain as it conspired against me. I tried everything to avoid it. If I could sense it coming from deep within my cells, I would try to sing a song or recite a poem or do anything I could think of to simply turn my brain off. But it would take hold, my fascia, then work outward through my muscles and tendons. Sometimes I would rock my body back and forth, vibrating, rattling, trying to drown out the pulsing noise and regain control of my body. Sometimes I would put my head under a pillow, trying to ignore the fact that the torture was coming from within me. But only exhaustion would override the rhythm, lulling me to the dream state beyond my fears. I would fight the haunting rhythm as it rose in me, often having to compete with my parents' fights in the next room. If my inner rhythm won, I was tortured by the tempo of my own obsessive brain. If my parents' arguing won, I was trapped by fear. One night, around that time, I hurled the pillow to the ground in frustration. I knew that my job was to hide, to stay in my room and pretend that this was not happening. I understood that they were only fighting because they believed that I was asleep. If I let on that I was awake, well, then I'd be disrupting the roles as they had been written. But I needed something from them, too. I wanted them to stop fighting because I needed to feel safe. Part of me wanted them to know that I knew that I heard them, that I was not being fooled by the smiles the next morning, but the whispers and the denials of their pain. I wanted to be in truth even then. That night, the pillow thrown to the floor, I'd had enough. I went out into the living room and yelled, "Stop! Please stop!" They stood still, perhaps in shock. My dad had been drinking. He was at the far end of our narrow kitchen. My mother stood across from him in the corner of our cramped living room, close to the door that led to our small terrace. Even then I could sense my mother's frustrated desperation. She looked at me for what seemed like forever, and then she started to cry. In my life I can count on one hand the number of times that I've seen my mother cry. This was the second. As she wiped her tears, she seemed to me to be sinking, drowning in an abyss of sadness. The mask she wore for my dad and for me when my dad was around had fallen away, washed off hours ago in the rage of their argument. But he was not done. He moved to the center of the apartment, pontificating, filling the awkward silence. She remained quiet, her eyes trained on me. It was clear that they had both said things to each other that would be difficult to forgive. We had all heard them. Watching me enter the stage in the middle of their war was a final stab at my mother's already wounded dreams. What she had dreamed of was a happy family. In her mind, she was supposed to be a successful working mother with a loving husband. She was supposed to have 2.5 kids, a couple of nice cars, and a schedule filled with service to her community and her family. She had wanted to create a world that was different from the one she grew up in. She aimed for a picture-perfect, upwardly mobile African-American home, filled with joy and love and success. She believed it was her job to have it all and do it all and be it all, and she was failing. My entrance into the room was a signal to her of her failure to protect me from the ugliness of the truth that was bleeding out of them both. My mother was overworked and underpaid. She was treading water in her career due to her inability or unwillingness to write in the brutal publish-or-perish world of academia. She was married to a man who seemed incapable of solvency and whose partying and drinking were a source of heartache. They had two nice cars, sure, but only one child, a child who had been virtually impossible to conceive and whose very existence was a stain of shared lies and shame between them. Looking back, I think my mother was trapped in the funhouse version of her dream, an upside-down reality filled with anger, fear, and resentment. Finally, she spoke. "Earlier," she said, wearily, almost to no one, "when I thought we were done fighting for the night, I told myself that I should go take a bath." Then she looked at my dad, daggers for eyes. "I thought about the gift that you gave me for my birthday," she said, "and I thought that I could put that homemade spa machine in the bottom of the tub and turn it on and maybe just relax." And then she turned and gazed at me, almost as though I were an apparition. "But then I thought, what if he throws the whole machine in the bathtub?" With that, she stopped, and I stood there, quietly not wanting to imagine her dead in that water. The next morning, as was always the case, it was as if nothing had happened. There was no discussion of the painful words that had been exchanged the night before. No reference to them at all, in fact. My mother smiled warmly at me as she prepared breakfast, and my dad slept through the early morning hours as he usually did. A few days later, I sat at my Aunt Daph's kitchen table and told her that if my parents didn't stop arguing, I was going to move in with her and my cousins, and I asked her to relay that to my parents on my behalf. Although my ultimatum felt genuine, given I was only 7, I was unable to follow through with it. I didn't want to be dramatic, at least not in that way. I decided not to give Aunt Daph any more details about my parents' late-night battles. I became more private and withdrawn. I resolved to stay in my room at night while the dreaded internal pulse of the rhythm terrorized me to sleep. My parents' battles were minor in comparison to the one that was raging within me. My mind and body became the enemy. I was trapped within them. I tucked away the fear and started to develop a role, a character that would stay with me. The good girl, the perfect child, the solution. It was clear that my parents had lost their ability to express their love for each other, but perhaps a shared love for me could help them find it again. Maybe my goodness could inspire a renewed tenderness between them, which would in turn create more emotional security for me, something that I so desperately needed. Perhaps there was no changing the reality that they had grown disappointed and disillusioned with each other, but I could make it better, or at least try. After all, I was their dream come true. If their personal failures had made it impossible for them to love themselves and each other, then I would be perfect enough so that they could experience whatever love they needed through me. Parts of this article were edited due to time. In culture and news, this next article, The View fans rally around Sherry Shepherd after sharing devastating personal loss. The former host mourned executive producer and show creator Bill Getty. It's been close to a decade since Sherry Shepherd was a co-host of The View, but she didn't hesitate to honor someone who had a hand in her getting a role on the daytime TV talk show. On July 21st, news broke that longtime television producer and The View co-creator Bill Getty died from coronary-related issues at the age of 68. As the show's current hosts publicly mourned the unexpected loss on TV, Shepherd, who was a panelist from 2007 to 2014, paid tribute to him with a heartbreaking Instagram. She acknowledged Bill's influence on her career and their friendship away from the spotlight. I am completely devastated at the passing of hashtag Bill Getty, the co-creator of At The View ABC, she wrote the same day as his death announcement. Bill took a chance and cast me, a stand-up comic with no talk show experience, as a co-host on The View. His instinct told him that people would relate to a black female single mom who had not one inch of political knowledge, but was just a real person. Shepherd continued, Bill completely changed my life because he believed in me. To be seen by someone in this industry who also has the ability to make you even better than you thought you could be, that was Bill Getty. He was a mentor, a great leader, and a wonderful friend. I love you, Bill. When folks read her emotional note online, many rallied around her and tried to uplift her in the comments. Wow, really sorry to hear about this. The View has been a staple in my life for decades, one person wrote on Instagram. Big hugs and prayers to you. His impact on you and so many others is immeasurable, another added. That's awesome to have been blessed in that way. Rest in peace to your friend and mentor, a different follower consoled. Along with Shepherd's personal message honoring Bill's legacy, she later returned to The View to highlight a funny moment cementing their unique relationship. He absolutely changed my life, she said on a July 24th segment. The first week I sat here, he fought for me to be here. I think my first week. Didn't I say I didn't know if the earth was round or flat, I think? I said, Bill, oh my God, I do know. I got to go back on and say it. And he said, nope, this is ratings, baby. This is ratings. Our next article is Lizzo breaks silence on lawsuit allegations, calling them false and outrageous. Usually, I choose not to respond to false allegations, but these are as unbelievable as they sound and too outrageous not to be addressed. Lizzo has broken her silence on allegations in a lawsuit brought by three of her former dancers, who, per CNN, claim they were subjected to a hostile work environment and harassment. These last few days have been gut-wrenchingly difficult and overwhelmingly disappointing. My work ethic, morals, and respectfulness have been questioned. My character has been criticized, Lizzo wrote. Usually, I choose not to respond to false allegations, but these are as unbelievable as they sound and too outrageous not to be addressed. She went on to say, these sensationalized stories are coming from former employees who have already publicly admitted that they were told their behavior on tour was inappropriate and unprofessional. Lizzo went on to say, in part, that she sometimes has to make hard decisions, but it's never her intention to make anyone feel uncomfortable or like they aren't valued as an important part of the team. She noted that she's not trying to be seen as a victim, but also knows that she's not the villain that people and the media have portrayed me to be these last few days. She went on to say, there is nothing I take more seriously than the respect we deserve as women in the world. I know what it feels like to be body shamed on a daily basis and would absolutely never criticize or terminate an employee because of their weight. I'm hurt, but I will not let the good work I've done in the world be overshadowed by this. I want to thank everyone who has reached out in support to lift me up during this difficult time. According to CNN, allegations against Lizzo include claims that her dancers were subjected to racial and religious discrimination by her employees. Additionally, one of the plaintiffs alleged that she was pressured into touching a nude performer at a strip club, while another plaintiff alleged that Lizzo made comments about her weight gain. The New York Times reports that the plaintiffs also claim they were exposed to an overtly sexual atmosphere that permeated their workplace and outings where nudity and sexuality were a focal point. Hey, this article is, yes, you can book a stay at Gwyneth Paltrow's guest house this summer. The package includes guided meditations, plenty of Goop-approved products, and a little quality time with Gwyneth herself. Stars, they're just like us. They drag their significant others to TJ Maxx for a full-blown shopping spree. Others even stealthily sneak into their pantry to steal their kids' snacks. And in the case of Gwyneth Paltrow, They worry about how we're losing connections with each other in an increasingly isolated world. Loneliness is a human condition, but in the past few years, increased isolation and our lack of community has made our lives even more fragmented. The Academy Award-winning actress wrote on a recent Instagram, "To help make the world a smaller, more connected space, Paltrow is teaming up with Airbnb to list her California guest house. On Tuesday, August 15th at 10 a.m. PST, guests can request to book Paltrow's dreamy digs, but only two lucky winners will be offered a one-night stay on Saturday, September 9th. During the trip, the chosen pair will enjoy a guided transcendental meditation, plenty of Goop-approved products, and perhaps a little quality time with the multi-hyphenate herself. While we may begin as strangers, I hope we'll find connections and commonalities over a delicious meal," she wrote on Instagram. "We know we had you at dinner with Gwyneth Paltrow, but the accommodations are especially exquisite. Then again, is anyone surprised? From her old apartment in Tribeca to her childhood home, Paltrow has proven time and time again that she's the queen of quiet luxury. Go ahead, take a look at this gorgeous guest house and be sure to mark your calendars. August 15th will be here before you know it." Exterior. The lucky guest's dream trip will start from the moment they reach Paltrow's guest quarters. Dripping in lush foliage, this property looks like it was pulled straight out of a Nancy Meyers movie. This is nestled right in nature, so you can come and have a zen moment with lots of light, fresh air, Paltrow said during a tour of her guest house. 2. Living space. Happy hour, anyone? Paltrow added a small home bar so guests can fix themselves a drink. For a multi-sensory experience, enjoy your cocktail at the small dining area, which features a marble table and four shearling chairs. 3. Kitchen. If you're looking for something a tad more filling, you can make a snack in the brass-laced galley kitchen. Once you're done, you can enjoy your meal in front of Paltrow's wood-burning fireplace. Speaking of dinner, Paltrow reveals in her guesthouse tour that she'll join you for a gourmet dinner in her wine room. "You can select whatever bottle of wine you want," she said. "We can enjoy a fantastic, cozy dinner with your guest and my husband. In other words, the double date of our dreams." 4. The bedroom. With a soothing color scheme and sun-dappled windows, Paltrow's guest house takes a beauty sleep to a whole new level. 5. Bathroom. Anyone who wants to enjoy little R&R should head over to the bathroom and enjoy the marble soaking tub, which is obviously stocked with Paltrow's favorite Goop cosmetics. "Your skin is going to be better when you leave than when you came," the entrepreneur teased. 6. Backyard. If Mother Nature is calling your name, venture out to the guest house backyard with an outdoor kitchen, pristine pool, and row of chaise lounges for optimal relaxation. There is endless fun in the sun to be had. Okay, we're in food, and this smoky corn salad is a hearty hit. So we have a recipe. You'll enjoy this recipe from Veg Forward by Susan Spungen. That's S-P-U-N-G-E-N. A hearty salad gets its smokiness from grilled corn, jalapeno, and charred scallions. Sturdy kale rounds it out and won't wilt on a warm day. It has 4 to 6 servings. The ingredients are 4 large ears of corn husked, 2 tablespoons of unsalted butter, 1 jalapeno, 12 scallions trimmed, 3/4 of a cup of Greek yogurt, 2 teaspoons of lime juice, 1/2 cup of roughly chopped cilantro, kosher salt and freshly ground pepper, 2 cups of shredded lacinato kale stripped from the stems of about 6 large leaves, 1 pint of cherry tomatoes halved or quartered if large, and 2 to 3 ounces of feta, and the last ingredient is 1/2 teaspoon of smoked paprika, plus more for finishing. Directions. Step 1. Heat a grill to medium-high. Wrap 2 ears of corn and 1 tablespoon of butter in a snug packet with heavy-duty foil. Repeat with the other 2 ears. Step 2. Place the foil-wrapped corn directly on the grill and cook for 5 to 6 minutes on each side. Place the jalapeno on a cooler spot on the grill and cook for about 8 minutes, turning to browned evenly. Open one of the corn packets to make sure the corn is caramelized and brown. If not, turn the heat to high and grill for 2 more minutes on each side. Remove from the grill, open the foil packets, and let the corn cool somewhat. Step 3. Lay the scallions perpendicular to the grill grates and cook 1 to 2 minutes on each side until charred. Cut into 1-inch lengths, set aside, finely chop the jalapeno, leaving the seeds in behind. Step 4. Using a sharp knife, cut the kernels from the cobs into a bowl. Step 5. Whisk the yogurt, lime juice, and cilantro in a small bowl. Season with salt and pepper to taste. Add the chopped jalapeno a little at a time, tasting as you go to get the right heat level. Step 6. Add the kale, half the scallions, half the tomatoes, half the feta, the smoked paprika, and the dressing to the bowl and toss to combine thoroughly. Season with salt and pepper to taste. Step 7. Transfer to a serving bowl and top with the remaining tomatoes, scallions, and feta. Generously sprinkle smoked paprika over top and serve. Here are a few gifts for 25 birthday gifts for your sister, no matter what age she'll be. Number 1 is New Moon Beginner's Birth Month Gemstone and Flower Candle. Give her a candle that represents her birth month, handcrafted with a blend of flowers, birthstones, herbs, and fragrant essential oils that are specific to each month of the year. It's the perfect gift for any age. It's $30 at Uncommon Goods. And here is a birthstone ring, a custom pendant designed specifically for the recipient's birthday. She's sure to adore this magical piece, featuring 4 gemstones and crystals carefully selected by astrologers to create a unique piece of jewelry for years to come. And the birthstone ring is $125 at birthdate.co. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson. I'm reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. And so long until next time.